Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, April 22nd. I'm Ray Graff. History is on the table today. We welcome back our favorite historian, Catherine Sheehan, executive director of the Hart Clewitt Museum and the Rensselaer County and Troy City historian, a native of Troy. Kathy has lectured on various history topics, including Uncle Sam, the Underground Railroad, public health, women's suffrage, agriculture, the whole nine yards. You have a question about regional history? Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. History with Kathy Sheehan, and your calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's History Today, and joining us once again is Catherine Sheehan. Kathy is the executive director of the Hart Clewitt Museum and the Rensselaer County and Troy City historian, a native of Troy. Kathy's career at the museum began when she was an intern from the public history program at SUNY Albany. She is the author of a publication entitled Architecture Worth Saving in Rensselaer County Revisited 50 Years Later. Catherine has lectured on many local history topics, recently has been a location and historic background advisor for HBO's production The Gilded Age. She has appeared on national TV, international TV, C-SPAN, the History Channel, Russian and Japanese TV. Kathy can be often seen giving tours through downtown Troy and Oakwood Cemetery. Always great to have her on the show. The number here, if you have a history question about our regional past, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. That's the phone number. And the email is voxpop@wamc.org. Kathy Sheehan, how are you?
Hi, Ray. It's good to see you again.
You told me before we started this is getting to be the busy time.
It is a busy time, yeah. It's the spring, especially going out into the far reaches of the county. You know, I love going out to Steventown and Berlin and up to Hoosick, but I don't like going up there in January and February when, you know, coming down at night through the mountains, it's like, eh. So they're like, okay, can you come up in March and April and May? So.
When they say, when can you come up? What do you mean, give talks?
I give lectures we have, of course, 14 towns in Rensselaer County. So each of the towns have, most of them have a historical society or they have different groups of the libraries and things to get together. So, yeah, I come up and talk about all sorts of
topics. What's a topic that has come up recently?
I just finished one on the wild women of Rensselaer County.
Oh, really? I knew a few of those myself back in the
day.
There
you go.
What's new at the Hart Clewitt?
Oh, gosh. We are open for the season. We're doing our tours and getting ready for the boats coming up. The American Cruise Line's coming in. Anna Doran, our education director, has got a full slate of I'll be doing a talk right at the museum on the Great Fire of May the 10th of 1862. We do a lot of these Thursday night. We're open late on Thursday evening, so we try and do some things like that. Of course, Amy Halloran has been our artist in residence.
She's a piece of work, that one, I'll tell you.
She's having
that.
A great time going through the archives, and we're just having a ball with her.
Do you ever have to say, stop now, Amy? It's time to stop?
Never.
No?
No. So, no, usually when she leaves by the end of the day, I'll think of four other things. I got to remember to tell Amy when she comes back in.
You brought things with you, but first you mentioned the Great Fire of 1862. Yeah. I don't know much about this. Tell me.
The May the 10th of 1862, it was really a seminal moment in Troy. The Green Island Bridge, which everybody knows, you know, we got many bridges crossing the Hudson, was a railroad bridge, and it was a wooden-covered railroad bridge. Well, sparks from a locomotive going over the bridge from the Albany side to the Troy side set the roof on fire, and it was a very, very windy day, and it literally created this firestorm that went to the east, destroyed a good portion of downtown Troy in the business district, all the way up to 8th Street, kind of where you see the edge of where now the RPI campus is.
Yeah.
750 some odd buildings. We're in the middle of the Civil War. You know, of course, Troy was big wartime production. There was about 15 people who died, unfortunately, in that fire. It's amazing that it wasn't more, but we had a steamer fire pit, which was one of the things that helped save that. We also had a lot of brick buildings and things. So
we lost some things. You know, when I look at And just time will do this. Years ago, I took an Albany history course at St. Rose. Mm-hmm. And you look at these pictures from the early 1800s, mid-1800s, and you say, well, that's gone. Yeah. That's gone. That's gone. What did we lose in the 1862 fire that we will never see?
Yeah, a great deal of the early business district in down Troy that's right near the Green Island Bridge. It went from Federal Street down to Broadway, around to Broadway. And those buildings were gone. And then what was interesting, though, is a lot of people know about urban renewal. Of course, we saw that here in Albany.
Yeah.
And in Troy as well. And in Troy, it almost covers the exact footprint of the 1862 fire.
Interesting.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Which I'll be doing a talk and go to ourheartcluet.org and you'll find out I'll be doing a talk on urban renewal.
This is so interesting because in the middle of a civil war, which takes resources, mm-hmm. how long did it take the city of Troy to get back on its feet after that 1862 fire?
Well, here's how much money was in Troy. A lot.
Yeah.
9 months.
Really?
It was rebuilt.
You're
nine
kidding
months.
Me.
Yeah, and some of the things that they did were they put new laws on the books that you couldn't have wooden cornices. You had brick buildings. We have all these brick buildings.
Yeah,
and metal, you have fashioned metal cornices. The setback on the street is pushed back 3 or 4 more feet, so you have this wider sidewalks and everything to try and mitigate future fires and things like that. So, which was really interesting. And then you have these amazing brownstones now that people, if anyone's familiar, just Fifth Avenue alone from Federal Street down to Broadway, you're looking at those rows. But it was fast. It's really interesting when you look at what during urban renewal, that was pretty much almost the same footprint.
We're joined today by Catherine Sheehan, who is director of the Hart Clewitt Museum and the Rensselaer County and Troy City historian. What'd you bring?
I brought some show and tell thing.
So I see earrings there, right?
You do see earrings, and these actually are made of human hair.
What?
Yes, they are.
I don't want to touch
those. I know.
They're neat, though. They look.
Aren't they cool? These are just for our listeners, since we don't have video here.
Right.
These are like a teardrop earring, and it's like woven hair.
How do you weave human hair that intricately?
Well, this became kind of schoolgirl arts of. This is a Gilded Age thing.
Yeah.
Some of the ladies who weren't working in factories 14 hours a day, 6.5 days a week, it was called fancy work. And and it became the rage. So now it was fun. My granddaughter's Girl Scout group came to the museum last night, and we were looking at a hair wreath, these big, huge hair wreaths that were framed. And the kids are funny. They have no preconceived notions. They thought, that's so cool. And all the adults are like, ew. And of course, a long time ago in the late 18th century, early 19th century, hair was a mourning piece. You would have your hair woven, put into a locket or something like that of the deceased loved one. That went out of fashion. This came in the late 19th century as a fun thing to do. So you would cut locks of your friend's hair, and you'd weave it, and then you might take some of these pieces to a jeweler, and they would put the little gold pieces on or put a little watch fob on it.
It's amazing it's held up all this time.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, they'd be treated, and there was a way you had little wires they wrapped around them, and they were, these are incredibly, it's really pretty cool.
I mean, if you wanted to destroy one, I bet we could do DNA analysis and find out who was.
Who was.
Cool.
It's so cool. So then the other couple things I bought. These are things that we should remember. These are just coins.
Dime? What's that?
Yeah, take a look. Those are
good for one fare. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. This is a bus token?
Yep. Bus tokens, the old United Traction Company.
Oh, my word. That's a trolley?
Well, they did have trolleys, and then, of course, the buses start in the 19th century of the trolleys. We just finished doing an exhibit at the Amtrak, or at the rail station over in Rensselaer. And actually, we're going to have another small column. So the big columns, when you go into the mid, there's an exhibit on history of rail transportation. And United Traction Company comes in the 1890s, and they're here till 1971, I think, is when CDTA takes over.
And so how long were those tokens used and not cash money?
Oh.
Because the bus that's on one of those looks 50s era.
Yeah, that was the Fifth Avenue Bus Company, which went from Albia all the way up to Corliss Park. We used to, this was gold when, you know, those of you that went to Catholic High, you know, because we had United Traction Company buses. We didn't take school buses when I was there. I graduated in 1973. And it wasn't until my senior year that I had school buses. So you had a big token that was for school only. So twice the size of this one. But the Fifth Avenue Bus Company had these little ones, and you were three blocks closer to school if you could score a fifth. I grew up in Beeman Park, so I wasn't scoring the Fifth Avenue bus one. I was taking the other one down the hill. But everybody had these. United Traction Company, and this is what you're using until they start. And they used them even when CDTA was first. They had the coins, and then they went to the swipe cards, and God, you know what they have now.
So the one, do you know the ages of these?
Yeah, these are all around, this is around 1950.
Okay, so yeah, I had that one right.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, I have a stamp and coin show tomorrow.
Oh.
And I'll ask the coin
the
expert about
right.
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Number here
yeah.
is 800-348-2551. Yeah. And so that other thing is to hold the tokens?
Yes, this holds your tokens.
Oh,
right.
That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, cool. So you just press it down, and then you slide the little token in, then you can put it in your pocket, and you got it all.
I vaguely remember that.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember those things. Let's take a quick break. We're joined today by Kathy Sheehan, Executive Director of the Hart Clewitt Museum at Rensselaer County, a Troy City historian. You got a question about the regional history? 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Lulu, there's Kenny Burrell and group here on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. It's history today with Catherine Sheehan. You can email us as well at 800-348-2551. Okay, before we get to the calls and the emails, a couple more things to show me. What's in the box?
Well, we're getting, the season's come. The ice is off the Hudson and the Mohawk. So here's all the scullers, the racing scullers out. And those are just some of the wonderful prizes and the court trophies that you got. And this was a pin that was done. That
it's
was
very
one
nice.
Of the tray. Very nice. And you can see the rowing. Rowing became huge. First off, it was there was a guy named Elisha Waters who made the boats in Lansingburg. He made a paper racing skull. And we have one on that. I think I maybe
yeah,
we
think
may
we
have
talked
mentioned
about
it before.
That
talked
time.
About before. We have it on display in our carriage house. But the whole sculling, and then people that the whole motorboat companies, up and down the Hudson. You get those beautiful Chris Craft boats that start coming out, and going on the lakes. People having a little more leisure time.
So that's 98 or 93?
Yeah, 1893.
1893. Wow, it's very well kept. So this is one of the things in a drawer at the Hart
Clewitt
that never is shown except once in a great while.
Yeah, they come out for exhibits, they come out for things. And then the other little thing I bought you, this is a salesman collar of Clewitt and Peabody. And it's tiny
for a pencil neck.
Yeah, so you have these guys who, the drummers who are the salesmen, they would go on the trains and you go to the different men's haberdasheries and things and you want to sell. Arrow had something like 2,000 different kinds of collars. But the reason I bought this was because we've just finished, if you follow golf at all, the Masters Golf Tournament was just on.
Oh, you're a golf aficionado?
I love golf. Yeah.
Do you play?
Not in a long time.
Okay. Right.
And I was
terrible?
Terrible.
Okay. Well, let's not go into your handicap.
My husband was a much better golfer than
I was. Fair enough.
But it's fun because the reason I brought this up was because Clewitt Peabody was one of the first sponsors of the Masters Golf Tournament when they went on TV.
Ah.
American Express was first, then Clewitt Peabody. And one of the things they did in the 60s and in through the 80s is they reinvented the Arrow Man. A lot of people think of the Arrow Man as that kind of in that Gilded Age.
With
the stiff collar and stuff. Well, that starts going out of fashion after the 1920s and 30s, and they're wearing just full shirts. They reinvent. They go into the chain constantly again, updating. They go into sports shirts. And so what do? They reinvent the Arrow Man, and they get Leroy Neiman to come in and reinvent the Arrow Man. And those appear on the Masters Golf Day. Think
darn.
Of all those
so
golf shirts.
This is the 60s?
This is the 60s. Wow. Into 1982, he did a full ad.
Mm, cool.
So it was fun. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it says par on it. So what does that mean for this collar?
That's the name of the collar.
It's a par.
It's a par.
Yeah.
Now, this is an early 20th century collar. This is around 1910. Sorry.
Neato. Yeah. We're joined today by Catherine Sheehan. It's History Today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. If you want to delve into something that is, you're questioning about the old days way back when in this area. Lindsay from Boston Spa writes in, I've been looking forward to this show for a while. Was the Brimmer family massacre well known in its day? Are there other families in the area with similar stories?
Yes and yes.
I guess qualitatively perhaps a massacre, but it wasn't a grand number of people. It was a couple of people who were shot, right?
Right, yes.
So tell us about that.
Yeah, so this took place up in the valley of the Little Hoosick, up in Petersburg, going up into Hoosick. And there was a farmer named Mr. Brimmer, and he had his sons. They were captured by a group of Native Americans.
The farmer was killed, right?
And then they were captured. The other ones were captured and taken to Canada and sold as slaves.
Now, this would have been in the mid-1700s.
Like 1755, okay. I think, somewhere around there, 1754, 55. And it was definitely written about in the 19th century. The published histories of Rensselaer County by, Nathaniel Sylvester, who did the big one. And they published a lot around through all the counties. And I think there was other instances of skirmishes and things like that. Most of those you're going to find out when you drive along the road and you see a lot of the New York State historic markers, Oh, yeah, but the side roads you do.
They need to be bigger.
How much bigger do you want those things to be?
I want them to be at least twice as big so I can see it as if I'm going 20 miles an hour, I can read it without driving into a tree.
Well, that's why they painted those nice blue and yellow,
Yeah, I love those.
Yeah. And you got to spin around. My dad always spun around. We got to go read the signs.
And your side of the river, is just such a magnificent area for these signs.
Yeah.
You go out past Oakwood Cemetery just such beautiful.
Oh, well, I'll tell you who I think gets the credit. Go down 146 out to Gilderland, and you're going. I have never seen more historic markers on that stretch.
Yeah.
Going from like the Gilderland Library all the way down into Altamont.
Yep, sure.
I think that's one. Isn't that 146?
Kings Road.
Kings Highway. Yeah, right off near where the preserve is for the. Brains go on.
Not much of a shortcut, but it's
off Fuller Road.
Ride.
You don't know that way. Yeah. There's a ton there on the Kings Highway.
Interesting. All right. So Lindsay, who has been waiting for this for a while, has three questions, which is beyond the limit. But because Lindsay's been waiting so long to get these in for you,
then we will do
number
this.
Two. The Gilded Age event with Caitlin Sheldon was such a treat. Do you have any more events like that on the calendar at the museum? What was that?
Oh, so she came in and did a whole show. It was wonderful. And it was a really rainy day, so we thought, maybe we get 20 people in. They kept coming in. We had like 75 people.
Wow.
It was crazy. She brought in a Victorian era dress. I mean, right down to she had her kind of chemise on and clothes, and then she would show how they wore the corset.
She had a corset and everything?
Oh, yeah. She had the corset and everything.
It must have been awfully uncomfortable.
She did a great job. She was wonderful. We will be doing some more again. We might be inviting her back. And there's a few other people in this area who also do historic clothing. So definitely, again, you got to just keep checking back at our website at hartkluett.org, and you will find listings of all these things coming up.
Kathy Sheehan is our guest today. I know you're a history nut, but do you delve into the history of clothing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
I mean,
yeah.
The subjugation of women who were forced to squeeze into corsets. Oh. Come on. It's torture, right?
Torture. Well, yeah. Well, and some of them, early on, they were made with whalebone and some steels, and they really could puncture. And so, they said a lot of that was some of that was like old wives' tale, but not true. I mean, those things were very sharp. They would constrict. A long time ago, PBS had that show where they put a family into a time period, and it was contemporary and filled them. And they did the one in London that was supposed to be 1890s, and they had the wood stove, and they were corseted. Well, the mom who was in there actually started developing like an emphysema because she couldn't get enough
full
deep
breaths.
From the coal, and she was breathing all these coal fumes and everything. And they had to because they were trying to really be accurate with this. And so they're, okay, you can release the stays a little bit. I'll never forget it. It was a great
amazing
series.
The human race has propagated all these years.
Oh, no kidding.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
All right, one more from Lindsay, and then we'll go to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Lindsay writes, what is your favorite offbeat fact about Troy that not many folks know but should?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one.
Yeah.
I got to have to think about that for a little bit.
Well, that's your homework for the next
time.
That's
what I do for the, yeah.
All right. Let's begin on our program with our friend, and she hasn't called in a week or two now, Joan in Schenectady. Hello, Joan.
I thought I might have insulted you after my last call. What? You know, whatever.
You know, did you hear the live event last Friday? It's very it's very tough to insult me. So you've done nothing wrong.
I loved it.
Yeah, okay. Hi, Joan. It's good to hear your voice.
Oh, my dear. Thank you so much. I have to laugh at your last few comments. I have been an extra actor on several local films and stages, and I actually fainted during a shooting of The Time Machine.
Oh, yeah.
It was so cold. The wool was so heavy. The corset was so tight. Oh, I got really good service all the way back to my house.
When was this, Joan?
Oh, Time Machine was what? 1998, 99.
Yep. And you were an extra?
Yeah.
Can we see you? I've never actually seen that version.
It was terrible.
If you no, because I fainted. But if you watch, what was the movie? The William Kennedy with Meryl Streep, Ironweed.
Ironweed. Yep.
You're in that one too, huh?
Okay. When she comes out of the bar just before she pukes.
Oh, nice.
Oh yeah, El Dorado over on 4th Street. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for that, Joan. All right, do you have a question?
I certainly do. When you all were last talking about the recreation of the transfer of the canyons through our location, and I guess there's a reenactment going on kind of local.
Yes, the Knox Trail.
Yes,
Henry
the
Knox.
Knox Trail. And I thought to myself, and most of my information is my historian mom and my, love for historical fiction. But there's always camp followers. There's always women. And I want to know more about who traveled with the cannoneers to support them as they traveled.
That's a great question.
Fascinating.
It is. And there were a lot of camp followers. And certainly, because, life had to go on. And they women were doing laundry and they were, following their family. A lot of them followed their husbands through the war. It's amazing.
Right.
You should check out Lauren Roberts, who's a Saratoga County historian. She has been leading the group for all of us coming from, because that when we did that Knox Trail, of course, starts up at, Lake Champlain, of course, all the way over to Massachusetts. So there is going to be a whole series of events. And I think she's having somebody talking about that coming up in this spring. So you should look at the Saratoga County webpage for that and see. Yeah, I think there'll be a whole talk up there. They'll be doing probably at Brookside, maybe over the Brookside Museum in Boston Spa, or should be doing it maybe in Saratoga, right at the casino. I'm not quite sure, but
interesting.
Check it out.
All right.
I want to know more. Yeah.
Joan, thank you so much for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. And now, because the Hall of Famers are calling in, it's time to go to Argyle. And Merle. Hello, Merle. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm sitting outside and having them put the apron out because it's too hot.
Yeah, man.
The question is, you said the person you're with, is that Kathy?
Kathy yes. Sheehan, yeah.
Hi, Merle.
All right. The question is, how much do you know about structural houses? I'm trying to age my house.
Oh, you're trying to dig
and
your house.
And one of the features is when they built it, they used on all corners 8x8. And then they notched it out to make it a 4x4 on the corner. Would that age the house?
Well, that's certainly not my area of expertise, but keep going. What's the rest of your question?
It's not your expertise.
It isn't, but I can say I know that there's a lot of archaeological centers around. And one of the ones that we've worked with that has worked a lot here in the Tri-City area is Harkin Archaeological. And they've done a lot of dating of buildings, and they'll do a scraping. They actually do dendrochronology.
Oh, yeah. On the wood.
On the wood to see how old they are. Because, I mean, we have a fair amount of early Dutch buildings that are, you know, they might be brick, but obviously you've got wood frames, a lot of mortise and tenon joints, like you're talking about. Darren Tracy probably would be able to.
That's a great idea. Yeah,
I would send him an email. You know,
eight by eight. That's a pretty sturdy house, Merle.
Yeah, yeah. I know one of the things that's really interesting, if you go into one of the basements of these early ones, they didn't clean off. A lot of times you see the bark on the bottom of the tree because it was in the basement. They didn't care about that part. You know, you literally see a hunk of tree holding up these buildings.
Go ahead, Merle.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
All right, buddy. Yeah, try it when Darren Tracy's on in a month or so. Appreciate it. Thanks. 800-348-2551 is the number. Catherine Sheehan, Executive Director of the Hart Clewitt Museum and the Rensselaer County and Troy City Historian, is with us today, and let's go to Troy. Felix, hello, Felix.
Hello, this is Felix. Yes, hi, I'm Amy Halloran's son, just to...
Wow, you come of good stock there, boy. Go ahead.
How are you, Felix?
good. I'm calling because I'm curious how many people would have died of waterborne diseases before the commissioning of the Tom Hanek or chlorination?
Great question.
That's my question.
It's a great question, and actually, as we speak, we have the large ledgers, particularly for Troy, of the cemetery ledgers, which, of course, say cause of death and everything. And there was a lot of cholera deaths, of course, yellow fever and things like that. But yeah, here's the interesting part, though, Felix. Even before the Tom Hanek, though, Troy had water systems, and if anybody's familiar with the way the hill is in Troy, and you know you've got these three big streams, but if you're familiar where Freer Park is, which is the Piscataquis Creek, that was one of the early waterwork systems from the Brunswick Reservoir all the way down through Freer Park. And Titus Eddy actually had the water system. And then you had not so much the Posting Hill, because that really was heavily used for industry. But there's a lot of underground streams. People still today go to Spring Avenue and get spring water.
Oh.
So yeah, and it's tested and it's good.
Good stuff.
Yeah, it's good stuff. You know, and then you know some of the other ones are coming up. You know, one of the other earlier water systems was from Grafton. So the Quackenkill Creek was channeled for early water
channeled
systems
underground.
At some points. Yeah.
Interesting.
So, yeah. But. Yeah, so there was, you know, water, and at some point you follow some of those things. If you look at, and again, I know I say this every time, if you want to go down a rabbit hole, go to that newspaper database, fulledhistory.com, and, you know, just put in something like cholera and things, and you'll see when these different epidemics came up. Or, you know, like that, at one point they were pumping river water out of the Hudson River. Found that, that's not too good.
Yeah.
you know, and that was before started, you know, this is the 19th century. You
right.
Know,
so it was before PCBs were.
Before
were
CBs, right, yeah, exactly.
All right. Felix, thanks a lot. Of course, you know, if you go back to the Dutch history, the 1600s here in Albany, all the kids were drinking small beer.
Small beer. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, you had the beer guys on.
You didn't want to drink the water.
No, you weren't drinking the water. Yeah.
There's always an excuse to drink beer.
To drink beer.
Isn't
there? Yeah.
Let's take a break. And Zach, the engineer, is nodding. 800-348-2551. Stand by, Zach. The weekend's almost here. Only a few days left. And then it's time for a small beer for a large engineer. Pass, Joy Spring, which was a great Clifford Brown tune here on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. History today with Catherine Sheehan, who is executive director Exactly. She has her own corner office, I bet, from the Hart Clewitt Museum and the Rensselaer County and Troy City Historian. And our number here, if you have a history question or want to bring something up, 800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Now, this whole Gilded Age thing is done, right? There are no more seasons coming?
No, I think they're coming back.
Really?
Yeah, pretty sure they're coming back for season 4.
Is that a fat old cha-ching for you? You're going to get some big money?
What's nice is we have a big meeting room space, and they rent it out for the extras to be able to hang out there until they need them.
Are the actors just insufferable?
No.
No, they're nice?
Fabulously
really?
Wonderful. In fact, one of the main players, Kelly Curran, who's from Slingerland.
Yeah.
And she was wonderful. And
I'm sure
it was funny. Somebody had talked about the weight of the clothes and things. And she told the story. She came and did a little event for us and talked about the weight of those cloaks that she had to put on because she was playing the maid first. And she season 2, she comes back as a rich woman. And so she said that thing weighed like 35 pounds.
Yeah.
And she had to buckle this thing around Carrie Coon's neck, and she's like, and it was like her first interaction, and Julian Fellows happened to be there that day, and she said it was a ride. She goes, it was made me so nervous. All I'm trying to do is buckle this thing, and it wouldn't buckle. And, you know, and of course, they're supposed to make it look like you've done it 1,000 times. And, you know, she finally said, I had to just kind of take a breath and
take 37.
And
here we go.
Yeah, she said she dragged that thing along. And Carrie Coons was pregnant also during filming of that, which was amazing. She dragged that thing around. And
you know, you bring up a great point, and I don't know if it's ever been discussed on this show, but were people stronger back then? Everything. I think about my kids who have to carry like 50-pound book bags, and they don't have time to go to their lockers because the people who run the schools have the classes so close together, so they're carrying. They're strong.
They are strong. Backpacks and front packs. My granddaughters carry like soccer bags in the front or their book bag in the front. The other, they have 2 backpacks now. It's like, oh my gosh.
And so these people who had to wear 35-pound cloaks, everybody must have been stronger.
I would think so. Maybe in some ways you had to do that. On the other hand, women of means, not like they had to go hauling things off. They just kind of had to. But, you know, it was funny. When they were filming at the music hall, we were talking about that, and they turned off the elevator there because you could hear all the background stories.
Right.
Get that. We're doing this. And all these people are like, oh, my God, we had to go up. And every time they did a take, they made them clear the hall and go back downstairs, and then come back up. And we had to go up and down those stairs. I said, well, what do you think they did in 1875? They said, yeah, but they didn't do it like 15 times in one night.
That's true. I wonder, when was the first elevator? We had Otis Elevators.
Otis Elevators.
Right? Was that around here?
1890. Well, I know the Rice Building, which is our version of the Flatiron Building. I think that was finished in 1871. And there were steam elevators that were there first by, I think, then the first electric ones are right around 1900.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the elevator in this joint?
No.
I'll show you before you leave. It's huge.
It's huge.
And so I believe this was a Nash dealership. This was a car dealership. And I'm pretty sure they put very heavy metal cars and brought them up to the second floor on this thing.
Right. Yeah. You have all these freight things.
I'll show you around the joint. All right. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Lynn is in Ankrum. Lynn, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon.
Welcome.
I have read that one of the pathways for the Underground Railroad was through Dutchess County into southern Columbia County, and that's where I live. So I'd like to know if the travelers actually came through my little town of Ankrum.
Oh, I know Ankrum. That's such a nice little town. Yeah, you know, it
you
did.
You do?
I do. I know. I'm one of these crazy people that just go driving around out in these country roads.
Well, I'm glad you do, but we're so small, no one ever knows about it.
No. You're not too far from, like, Hillsdale and over that way, too, right? Yeah. Yeah. No, that's beautiful, beautiful country over there. I love it. I love it over that way.
It sure is.
And you're right. There were these different routes because it's the people that were helping and down around your way and into southern Rensselaer County as well. Were a lot of Baptist churches, a lot of Baptist congregations were pro-abolitionist. They were supporting the movement. And so you're kind of going from, you know, it's the house to house and people there, the ministers in the church, the people of church helping that along. I was thinking of like Hillsdale, then up into like Sand Lake, just over the border, There was the First Baptist Church that was very well known as a spot on the Underground Railroad to help people through. So yeah, no, it absolutely did it. And of course, a lot of the freedom seekers came right up through the Hudson River. So I mean, that was the big conduit. You know, they're coming up on those packet boats and getting off into towns and then working your way up. And because these areas were a little more abolitionist friendly, sometimes they didn't leave right away either. They would get jobs and they would stay for a bit. Others were definitely just get us to Canada.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, depending on that. So, yeah, well, it's a great question.
Lynn, thanks a lot for the question. You know, just hearing Columbia County and some of the great towns and then Dutchess.
Yeah.
I got to say, I took the Taconic Parkway a few weeks ago, and it's been probably 30 years since I've driven the Taconic. I used to drive it all the time. And for the first time, I was a passenger. My daughter drove, and I'm looking at the stone walls that are on, if you're coming north, and they're all on the right, I think, Dutchess and into Columbia County. And they all seem mysterious to me. I'm sure that the farmers or whoever, not farming country, to be honest with you, but, you know, trees and hills and things.
It was at one point.
But then I got thinking about standing stones. And I know there are some caves in Connecticut that are somewhat mysterious. Are there any old stones that predate the Europeans that are there, that are in Columbia and Dutchess County?
Boy, that's a good one. I'd have to look that one up. I don't know, Ray.
Well, can you go out in the field and find out?
Yeah, go out in the field and find out. Yeah, well, I think our astute listeners need to chime in on that.
This is the sort of crazy stuff when you're the passenger on the Taconic for the first time ever. Rob is in Amsterdam. Rob.
Hi.
Hi, you're on.
Okay, listen, I had, by the way, I am the city historian of Amsterdam. So
hey.
Wow. In the same business.
Yay.
So, yes, small city, big stories.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you two questions, one of which is, what is the value of public or local history beyond its just value as history? And two, how do we find people who we can get interested in it and maybe even someday train our replacements?
Oh, those are great questions. Wow. Well, I think the value of local, you know, I don't think there's any such as local history that doesn't have some sort of a significant impact on our state and national history. They all do, because everyone contributes into that. And I think that's, if you have to make that case, I mean, look at Amsterdam. You had, you know, huge, the rug business, and I'm trying to think what else was out in Amsterdam. I mean, that was, it was nationally significant, not to mention that you're on the, you know, Erie Canal and, you know, you're on the Mohawk River and everything going through there. So, you know, you have an important history to tout about. And I think it's, you know, to me, it's the kids. You know, last night I had Girl Scout troop and it's, you have to get them interested in the story. And to me, you know, history is about a story. It's not, many people who know me now, you've been on the show a few times, you know, I'm horrible with like an exact date, time or something like that.
Good.
But to me, because it's like, does it really matter if it was, you know, a couple days off here or there? What's really important is what happened, and it's the people's story, and how we, and I think that's what people are interested in, and that's what I think gets our next generation of historians to come up and take the mantle when we decide that we don't want to do it anymore.
Rob, why did you get into it?
I think everybody needs a sense of being from someplace special, from understanding the land that they're from or that they live in. And I agree with Kathy. I mean, these stories do have national, you know, there's so many over in Troy, but even in my town, have national or statewide significance. And what you need to do is just, I felt like I was the speaker for the dead. You know, I had to get out there and tell people, you don't realize who used to live right where you live now or down the block and what they did. And but you're from someplace special, and you gotta take that into your identity and share it with other people. And we've had a lot of success in doing that, but it's a never-ending battle. It goes on and on and on.
Yeah, I think pride of place is really amazing, and I think the more that people do know about, you know, what happened underfoot in your own area, I think you develop that pride of place. I think one of the more fun programs we've ever did with after school kids, we took a big Sanborn fire insurance map and city directories, and it was kids that lived in this urban housing project, and they all looked up all the people that lived in their apartments and what was on the street, and they were just so amazed by all the things that people did and what their neighborhood looked like, and using the photographs that we all have in our collections. And then they're like, hey, this was really cool. You know, this happened right down the street. And I see these kids now. They're all like in their 20s. Hey, Mr. Shin, you know, they still remember it. It was great.
Hey, Rob, thanks for calling. You know, for me, why it's important is very similar to why astronomers try to figure out what the universe is about. It's really about you, the person. And so to look into the past, you really can't know where you are until you know where you've been.
Right.
And so I like everybody's history. Yeah. I like going to Amsterdam or whatever.
Me too.
I can't get enough of that.
Can't get enough of it. And it does. It understands there's a progression of how things happen. And it doesn't – nothing happens in isolation.
Right.
So
and humanity, there's a universality to humanity, which is just amazing. People are people pretty much everywhere.
Yes.
Governments differ and cultures different, but you get right down to it. We are the same.
We are.
This email from John Ankrum. Didn't they have a bare knuckle boxing match there in the 1800s? And the reason they had it in Ankrum was it would take the authorities too long to get there. I guess it was an illegal fight and it drew thousands of people. Do you know about that one?
I don't. I love that. No, but those kinds of things did happen all the time. They certainly happened on our side. And I know there are all sorts of boxing matches and things over here in Albany County. And it's like, yeah, I think there's like a whole underground of you know, those kinds
of
so cool events.
So Glenn in the 845 wrote, I've spent nearly 30 years investigating unusual cultural stone features in our woods. Many are believed to predate European arrival. Have me on sometime and I'd be happy to discuss. I'm in Woodstock. Glenn, you wrote a book, I believe, and I have that book, and it's very interesting indeed.
Cool.
And that's what I was thinking of when I was riding up the Taconic.
That's neat.
I want to know more about these old features. That's how do you find out, though?
Yeah.
You know?
I know. Yeah, that's what you need.
What was
all those, you know, that, like the archaeologists. That,
right.
You know, they're so fascinating to me.
Take us back to the Van Rensselaers for a minute. The very earliest days of your side of the river.
Yeah. Well, very earliest days, we have the Mohicans are there. Right.
You okay. Know. And you're absolutely right.
And the Van Rensselaers are there also pretty early on top of that.
Yeah.
You know, with the Dutch. And, you know, they're settling down Pepiscani Island, down below Albany on, you know, both sides of the river. And of course, they own both sides of the river, the Van Rensselaer family. But, you know, this was very fertile. This is very fertile farmland. It was farmed. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Our guest today is Kathy Sheehan, who is executive director of the Hart Clewitt Museum and the Rensselaer County, a Troy City historian. How do you shift your time between those three gigs? Do you do it all at once?
It all just happens all the time.
Bill three different entities? Good for you.
It's like, wait a minute, what hat am I wearing right now? So, yeah.
Well, we got a couple of minutes. We have a couple callers who are going through the screening process now. But in the meantime, what's coming up at the Hart Clewitt?
Yeah, so we have, again, we have our Thursday talks that are coming up, and then our guided walking tours through the downtown historic district. We do a lot of those on Saturday morning.
They
we
stop in the winter, right?
Well, Anna, you know, it's great to have a young staff. She's game. She'll take them out, you know. So we're actually doing a walking tour of the east side. We actually did the east side basically from Congress Street all the way out to like Winter Street, if those of you are familiar with it. It's a long span. So we broke this tour up into three different ones. So our last section, which is those of you would be from like Sacred Heart Church to Winter Street, is going to be May 3rd. I think there's a few spots left for that walking tour. I'll be doing that.
Yeah? How many miles is the tour? Like,
You're on for about an hour and a half. It's all flat. It's not
know.
A big deal. Come on, Ray.
Can I get a ride?
I'll be doing some tours in Oakwood this summer.
Look at Oakwood cemeteries.
Look at their webpage. We'll be doing some tours of things for that as well.
When was the first stiff dumped in that?
It's 1848.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, so it goes back.
Yeah. It goes back.
But there were also people who were Not people. Well, dead people who are transferred over.
They reinterred them, right. Yeah.
All right, let's go to quickly to Pad in Ankrum, who has background on the boxing match.
Oh, cool.
Hello, Pad, you're on.
Yes, hello, this is Tad, T-A-D.
Oh, T-A-D, you are welcome.
The story is this fight occurred when the corner of Ankrum and Massachusetts was actually a part of Massachusetts at the time. It's now called Boston Corners.
I've seen that.
And if you look on a map, there's a little triangle missing in the corner of Massachusetts. This town happens to sit on the Harlem Valley Rail Line, and they take the train up from the city, and they suddenly enter a little corner of Massachusetts, which meant there was no police.
Oh.
They had a fight that lasted apparently like 10 hours.
Wow.
I think it was Sullivan against Morrissey.
Ooh, Sullivan. That's a big
bout. Johnny
bout.
Morrissey? The guy that started Saratoga Racetrack? Who's a Troy boy?
Was it Gentleman Jack Sullivan? Or what was the guy's name? John Sullivan?
Like John L. Sullivan.
Yeah,
John L. Sullivan. Yeah.
Wow, that's cool. That's
He was here a lot.
A really nice historical marker right there on the site.
There you go.
When you drive by, you go, oh, look, there's one of those markers.
See? That's why we have to have them.
Hey, Tad, thanks a lot for the call. All right, very quickly, we only have about 30 seconds. Ryan in Albany. Ryan, go ahead.
So what's really interesting is what happened after the boxing match. So the boxing match went on for so long, people didn't have any food. There was such a huge crowd. They were just raiding farms. It was a lot of anarchy. Massachusetts and New York were fighting about who should bring the order. It's a really neat event. People should look it up.
That is so cool.
Definitely.
Well, thank you very much, Ryan, for calling. We appreciate it very much. All right, Kathy Sheehan, we only have about a minute here. How do people find out more about your fine endeavors?
Okay, so I am over at the Hartklute Museum of Historic Rensselaer County. We are located on 2nd Street in historic downtown Troy. And our website is hartclutt.org, and that will list all of our events, talks, tours, exhibits, everything coming up for the whole season.
And Thursdays are late nights?
Yeah, Thursday we do late nights. We're open till 8. Late night, or Thursday late to late or something like that.
What time is it usually open?
We're open noon to 5 normally. Thursday noon to 8. Friday, Saturday, 12 to 5.
All right, next time you're on, and you've talked about this before, but the history of that building.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that again. Yeah. You're scheduled again, right?
Yeah. I think you got a couple more times with
you. Kathy Sheehan, you're the best. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Ray. Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
See you next time. Support comes from Best Cleaners, offering dry cleaning, wash, unfold laundry, and tailoring services with pickup and delivery available throughout the capital region. BestCleanersNY.com. Ballet Flowers and Design, Malta, New York, a family-owned garden center and flower farm offering landscape, wedding design services, perennials, annuals, herbs, and interactive classes, balletflowers.com. And ArtSpark, Saratoga Springs, New York, digital marketing services dedicated to artists and their art, artspark.com for consultations. Once again, thanks to Catherine Sheehan for being here from the Hartklute. Thank you for listening. Great calls, always great calls on the History Show. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your calls were screened today by Ed Rosen. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Stamps and Coins. David Tripp and Bob Scott will be here. If you've got something jingling around in your pocketbook and you think it could be worth something, you never know. Give us a call. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.